Kia ora, and welcome to Raw On Air, where we bring you inspiring youth voices from across Auckland to discuss race and the impact of race in their lives in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Join us for music, insights, and meaningful discussion about race as we hear from a range of insightful, courageous, and thought-provoking youth from across Auckland. Kia ora, welcome to Raw On Air. This week we're sharing an interview that we recorded in September last year with Andrea Johnson from the Courageous Conversation Global Foundation. She was visiting at the time to set up meetings with schools and young people to discuss RAWA, Rangatahi Organised Against Racism. Unfortunately, Andrea was unable to join us this week as planned to host and front a number of events that we had scheduled due to COVID-19. So we send a big shout out to Andrea, who is on lockdown in the States, and hopefully we'll be able to bring her out later in the year and chat with her again then.
Kia ora. We're so excited to welcome Andrea Johnson from the Courageous Conversation Global Foundation to join us today. Welcome, Andrea.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
So it's your first week in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Tell us a little bit about what brought you out here.
So we came initially to do a program with university students at the University of Auckland. And we began working with those students about 3 months ago, and we had them learn the tools of courageous conversation and really leaned into what they know about being youth here in New Zealand. And we learned a lot from the youth, and they put a program together with assistance from my staff here on the ground, and we rolled it out this week, and it was a really exciting program and gave me a chance to see what young people are thinking, to experience the enthusiasm that youth have here about having conversations about race.
Tell us a little bit about the highlights of that event. What stood out to you?
The most exciting thing about the program was to see the growth of our leadership team. We started with 5 young women, and some of them knew each other and some of them didn't, and none of them knew any of our courageous conversation tools. So to go from having them learn the tools and learn about each other to a few weeks later, we did a Zoom conference with me in the United States and them here in Aotearoa, and they were still a little timid and weren't quite sure whether or not their ideas were going to come to fruition. They didn't know whether they'd get enough young people to sign up to come and spend 2 days on campus having courageous conversations. And even in that Zoom conference, I saw them grow. I saw them come into a leadership space. I saw them proud. And when I got here, the first full day I was here, we met for a day. And to see them lead part of the meeting was pretty awesome. That was a highlight for sure. Another highlight was as we got into the space on the first day of our workshop, and there were just a few of us there, right? So there were the 5 youth, there was our ICCAR team, and some students, some Tongan students, because we use the Faye, and they were there with us, and there was electricity in the room, and that was a highlight, the anticipation. We had no idea of the over 100 students who'd signed up to come, who was actually going to show up. And when the first few university students showed up, it was just really cool to feel what that was like for our young people who'd planned. You can look in their faces and see they were like, oh my goodness, this is real. There's somebody here. So that would be a second highlight, that. And then the third highlight was on day 2, the young people who were in leadership tapped other young people in the room to share their thoughts and talents. And it was pretty awesome to see them pass the baton, if you will, to other people in the room. And they could then have the same level of ownership of the work we'd done together. So those are the three highlights for me.
I can totally relate to the energy and passion of youth and the dynamic that brings to an environment when we're talking about courageous conversations about race. And that sense of empowering others to join in the conversation is really key. So what are the plans for the program going forward?
Well, for our university students, they've already registered as an official organization on campus. And that was one of the goals, right? For them not just to have one event and then we're done, but for them to be established on campus. And they got over 20 of the youth who were there to sign up to be a part of the organization. And so they will have to figure out what that looks like for them, given they have a structure now. And what I hope happens is that they will have some benchmarks where they'll have some activities throughout the year, maybe two key activities or three key activities. And the rest of the time, they have the skills now to start pushing the university to be courageous, right? And to respond to their stories now that they have a way of telling their racial stories, and to impact policy and to impact course offerings and to impact the various things that they have access to on campus from their racial perspective. So that's what I believe will happen, because the structure is now there for it to happen. And I also am hopeful that they will reach back to younger students, to high school, to students perhaps even in grammar school, and give them some of what they have, right? So they can be mentors for them, so that this next generation behind them is able to step into these spaces that they've now opened up and created. We have three things that we think about in our work that are resting on Kemetic principles from ancient Kemets, the land that we call Africa, right? That vast continent. And we think about some of the early scholarship in Kemet. And the first one is know thyself. And that's one of the things that happened with this program. Our young people were able to know themselves better. The second one is distinguish knowledge from foolishness. And the tools that they have allow them to begin to do that more effectively. And the last one is to build for eternity. And that speaks to this mentoring and building something that someone else can step into and reaching your hand back so that you can pull someone else up into consciousness so the world would be different.
I share that hope. And it's amazing that you've been able to kind of touch on each of those principles and bring them forward with such a young group. How exciting. So this is your first visit to Aotearoa, New Zealand. You've been here for how many days now?
I have been here for 6 days now.
Right.
Yes.
So are you able to share some of your thoughts, reflections, observations?
Yes. When I knew I was coming, I did the usual research about New Zealand. I looked at some books and thought about what I might want to see. And once I got here, I realized that what I really needed was to interact with the people. And although there are some beautiful spaces on this land, for this particular trip, my goal was to connect to as many different people as possible, because no matter how beautiful a land is, it's really about those folks who live here every day and have a connection to this land. And so from that perspective, I have found the people to be a warm people. I have walked quite a bit in the areas near the hotel where I'm staying, as well as being able to walk on campus. And I've had people look me in the eye, which is very important. I think when I'm in a space, it does not happen everywhere. And I also have discovered that in terms of racial consciousness, there's not just one way to show up, that there are New Zealanders that I've interacted with during my time here who are very conscious of who they are racially and who they are culturally and are skilled or ready to have the conversation. And I've run into New Zealanders who have no idea and will say, what do you mean you're here doing a program on race? We don't have any issues around race. As a matter of fact, even on the airplane coming, one of the flight attendants asked me, that long flight, yeah, right? That long flight from the United States. She asked me what I was doing. Was I vacationing? I said, well, no, I'm coming to do some work. And she asked what kind of work. And I said, in the racial equity space. I used the term diversity because I thought that'd be something she'd really understand. I said race relations, racial healing. She was a white-skinned woman who self-identified as a Muslim woman. And she said, well, I don't think there are any race problems in New Zealand. I know there are issues around religion. And she gave me this look. I think she saw a look on my face because my face talks, mm-hmm, whether I'm talking or not. And she said, so you don't agree with me, do you? And I said, nope. I said, there are race problems everywhere. And from the people that I've talked with before coming, I know there are race problems in New Zealand. And she went, Then she said, maybe I don't recognize it because I'm white. Wow. And I was like, yes, right? So that's an example of me encountering a New Zealander on my way here, having a conversation about race, where she was in a space where she didn't have the consciousness around race and racism happening here on this land, whereby there are other people I've talked to since I've been here again who know deeply that there are, and when I say issues of race, I don't necessarily mean negative all the time, but that race plays out in this place. And the way it plays out advantages some people and disadvantages others. So
based on the people that you've connected with and the conversations that you've had, starting with that one, and others that you've spoken with over the week, what learning are you going to be taking back to the States?
So I'll answer that a little differently.
Sure.
So you asked me what learning I'm going to take back to the States, and the way I'll answer it is, what stories am I going to tell about this place when I go back, right? So I'm going to tell the story of that the people, as I said a little earlier, who are warm and inviting and look you in the eye and are willing to engage. And I'm also going to tell the story of a culture of youth who are poised and ready to take up the mantle for racial healing across the globe, because that I felt so strongly in the room of 60 or so young people at the university. I'm also going to tell the story of individuals who don't always know how to do racial equity work, but are open to doing it and believe that this country is small enough for us to have a profound impact in a lot of spaces, which is very different from working in the United States. We had a conversation earlier today with someone that asked me whether or not university students in the U.S. who are doing racial equity work with us would be interacting with younger youth at like high schools, et cetera, and junior highs. And I said, no, not necessarily, because we're such a big nation and we don't necessarily have the pipelines in proximity to make that happen on a regular basis. It could happen periodically. But what I found here is there are connections that can be made because you're a smaller country and we can reach folk in spaces where they can reach out and hold each other's hand much more readily. So I'll tell that story too.
Yeah, that's amazing. Just thinking about kind of scope and size.
Well, even with the Christchurch massacre that happened here and the ways in which government was able to respond pretty quickly, and that hasn't happened in the U.S. And I believe part of that is due to scope and size and bureaucracy. Not that you don't have problems here, right? I know you do. And I know that the things that happened immediately are not a magic fix. However, there's something that is powerful about being able to reach across sectors a little more fluidly because of size.
Yeah, that's really interesting to get your reflections on that. Just on the Christchurch massacres, and, you know, as you talk about racial healing, what did you experience, you know, following that event, coming in kind of 6 months later? What came up in your interactions or experiences around that?
The thing that came up around the Christchurch massacre during my time here was a reference point. So there were several people I interacted with during these 6 days who would reference that as an awakening or reference it as a confirmation. So the awakening, there were folk who were saying, I really hadn't thought about that kind of a heinous thing happening here. And there were others who were saying, I knew it was going to happen. I just didn't know when and where. Right. And so both of those conversations I had with different folk here, and whether the conversation was someone saying it was a ticking time bomb waiting to happen or, oh, my goodness, I had no idea. There's still a commonality in knowing about it, and you can't deny it. There's no denial. Right. It's impossible to deny that there's an underbelly that's a very heinous underbelly present here in this country, just like other places around the globe. And as you know, we're a global foundation and we know that that underbelly is everywhere. And unless we are armed with the language to have a conversation about it, believe that it's there, we can't do anything about it. And so that belief was activated by that massacre. As you know, I live in Las Vegas, Nevada, and we had a massacre there the year before in October. And over, like, I think 55, 57 people were killed. And similarly, there, as often as there are massacres and mass shootings in the United States, there were still folks in the town I live in right now who thought, oh, this can't happen here. And it did. And so that conversation rests in what we call our belief quadrant. So it forces one to believe that it can happen and that can lead to healing, because unless you believe it can happen, then If you don't believe it will happen, then you can't enter into a space where you can participate in activities that mitigate that hate and lead to healing.
Mm-hmm. I must admit, reflecting on that time, my immediate response was disbelief. And it wasn't disbelief that it had happened. It was probably more connected to, I can't believe this happened here. So, yeah, everything that you're saying kind of resonates with me. And, you know, 6 months down the track, as we lean into speaking about racial healing, what did you experience as the appetite, awareness for, need for, willingness to kind of move in that direction over the past kind of week?
I haven't had many conversations directly about racial healing. Most of the work that I've done since I've been here and the conversations I've had have been more about connections and how can we use tools of courageous conversations to connect around difference. But I do have some thoughts around the healing piece, particularly given that the foundation has a real focus on racial healing. And I know that we've used the tools of courageous conversations as a vehicle for healing to happen. So I believe that the people of New Zealand, and particularly here in Auckland, are ripe to use those tools for healing to occur. One thing we know in our work is solutions that are derived at when one is in pain are different solutions that one derives when they're in a healing space. And so in order to not only wrestle with what's happened here or what may even happen again, one has to work through the pain, and our tools can help you do that. And when you come through some of the pain to the other side, you can begin to say, okay, how are we going to be as a nation? It's funny. I know that the terms, this isn't who we are, that came up a few times here.
It did.
And I would offer, yes, it is.
And that came up almost immediately.
That's right.
Yeah.
It did come up. And it's kind of like, no, it is. If you distance yourself and say, that's not us, why would you be compelled to do anything? But when I look at someone and say, my humanity is wrapped up in this person's humanity, even if they're far away from what I want to be, they are part of the community. And I want that element in the community to be different, right? To be different. And how can we make that happen?
You know, just thinking about scope and size and us and community, I get that we could be considered, you know, like New Zealanders, like we're kind of all the same. I'm interested in how you see race operating here in New Zealand.
Yeah, New Zealanders are not all the same. I know that just in a few days.
Yeah.
Right? So physically, walking around, I saw brown faces, I saw black faces, I saw white faces, I saw Asian faces from various places on the Asian continent. I've learned some language around that, right? So the term Pacifica is used quite a bit, and I didn't know what that meant when I came here, and I'm beginning to have a little bit of meaning constructed around that. And I also am discovering that there are many people that get caught up in that term, right? The Maori culture and folks who have a legacy and lineage as indigenous Maori people are varied. We've got brown, very dark Maori, white skinned. The consciousness is varied. And so I've spoken with New Zealanders who show up brown and have consciousness that I would say is rooted in whiteness. And I've talked to New Zealanders who show up white or Pākehā. And they have consciousness that is outside of whiteness, right? They've got some racial consciousness that's different. So it's a very vast and varied racial landscape. And I have encountered that in other spaces, right? Just other places I've been around the globe are the same way. We do an activity called the Color Line in our training, and wherever I've seen it done, including here, the lightest to the darkest show up on the line, and that is race, right? The race you're perceived to be, as well as how you perceive yourself.
Mm-hmm. So, the differences in consciousness based on race and not connected to how you show up physically. What kind of complexities have you witnessed or observed between people of color and Indigenous people? So, thinking about interracial connections.
I think in this brief time, the complexity that I've witnessed has been in having conversations across lines. And I saw, for example, during our university workshop, the first day early on, I saw young people who may have a mixed heritage, right? So have one parent who's Maori and one parent who's not, and some conflict even within themselves about jumping into the conversation. Are they brown enough or are they too white? That I witnessed that. And so when you talk about across racial lines, that's even within an individual. And also I saw a willingness to communicate with people that were different, even if it started out in hesitation. I believe a lot of that had to do with not having skill. And as the skills were gained, the confidence also came with that. And there was more conversation. I will say, though, that there's a culture of niceness here. And I have found being polite and nice as a cultural attribute gets in the way of having deep conversations, again, without skill. So I have found that to be something that I've sensed here. And I don't know if you find that living here be true.
Yeah. So, politeness, people are polite and we're kind of kind to each other and we back away from making each other feel uncomfortable. I have experienced that myself. The things, I remember the first time I heard a famous person say, "I don't feel brown enough." I think it was Mariah Carey on Oprah. And what's familiar to you about the interracial complexities that you witnessed here compared to your own kind of story?
Honestly, I didn't see much difference, right? I guess one would refer to me, if I didn't tell you what to call me, someone would refer to me as an African American. And in the African American community, there's a lot of what we call colorism. And so if you're darker complected, there certain meaning that's made out of that if you're lighter complected. And so much of that goes historically to the transatlantic slave trade, where those African Americans who were conceived by the person who owned them, who were white, and their black slaves got privileges if you came out lighter, right? Had access. And so I see some of that here as well, where there's light skin privilege that happens among brown people and judgment passed based on skin color. So that colorism in the Maori people that I've met here, as well as some of the other Pacific Islanders and other people in general. I even had the opportunity to interact with some students who are here from the continent of Africa, and listening to them share their stories about some divisions, even though they all come from the same continent, because they're not from the same country, and they may show up either, it may not be their skin color, it could be other cultural attributes that are different, that there's some division there. And again, I know that the tools of courageous conversation help us to bridge those, right? So that that discovery of self first, that reaching out to those who share one's cultural and racial perspective and experience, and then reaching across racial lines. That's the work that we do, and it played out here for sure, for sure.
Just thinking about, you know, starting with self, and just kind of deepening our conversation about racial healing. What does it look like for a nation to heal? So if we're each kind of starting with self, then what does it look like from 4,000 feet?
For an entire nation to heal? Ooh.
What's your vision?
That's
at 4,000 feet?
Vision. I believe that it's, and this may sound a little trite, but it's one person at a time with one person at a time. And often when we talk about a national story, in this particular milieu, if you will, world that we're living in right now, that national story is reflected in television, in films, in social media, right? So there's so many spaces. And for healing to occur, I believe all of those factions have to be influenced. And if I turn on the television set and I'm watching a news program, the kind of language that's being used there and the stories, the narratives, right? What stories are being told are going to shape what I believe and how I interact with my nation or the nation that I'm in, because sometimes that's the only window in. Or if I'm on Instagram, or I don't know, do you guys have Snapchat?
Yeah, I don't use it. I'm a little bit
right.
Not
Instagram,
down with Snapchat.
Snapchat, Facebook, any of those things. The tricky part of that in terms of impacting an entire nation is, though the online platforms can be infiltrated so quickly by folks who are not of that nation. So it really is going to depend, again, on that human interaction one-on-one, right? Who am I? Who are you? When we see each other, how are we going to talk to each other? What's happening in schools? Schools are spaces that are designed to pass on norms and pass on culture and develop young people to be whatever the nation wants, right? Whether it's a private school or a state school. I believe that's a big piece of it, that as we interact with schools and school children and the people that design the state tests, to have them be not just culturally relevant, but also be rooted in a philosophy that is about racial harmony and healing. That's a big part of affecting a nation.
I don't think that sounds trite at all. Thank you for sharing. Interested in how race played out for you as an African-American woman, as you kind of made your way around this week?
So I didn't see very many people that looked like me walking around. That was kind of interesting. It wasn't like I've been to some countries where I saw absolutely no one who was brown or dark. I won't name the country. I don't want a country bash, but I was in one country and I felt like I really needed to get out of there in that particular city in this country just because it was so isolating to go in every single space and only see white faces and not see any brown people. So although I didn't see any people that I or many people that I could quickly identify as being African-American, there was enough variety in who I saw where I did not feel isolated here. And so I felt connected. And some of it may be because I was escorted by or walking around with people that I know that did shape my experience. I was rarely out and about without someone who I know already. And those folk that I know here are largely of color. And if they're white, they're conscious white folk. So I don't know that I would have had the same experience had I not been escorted around by my conscious white and brown folk.
Just thinking about racial privilege, if we go a little bit deep now, racial privilege and power, what comments do you have to make about white norms that you experienced in New Zealand?
So most of the white norms that I experienced here were either in the hotel or in some of the, we did some school visits. And so what I experienced was I call it a level of being austere. And it was very familiar to me. So it wasn't unfamiliar, but I definitely recognized it as whiteness. For example, we were at the hotel and this wasn't austere, but it was definitely whiteness. So we were at the hotel and we were trying to park the car and just have a waiting area and not go into the parking garage because we weren't going to be there very long. And there was there were two white men who were in charge of valet, and they were pretty relentless in trying to tell us that there was a certain way for us to behave. And I do find that very common in whiteness, where there's a rule, and if you don't fall in line with whatever the rule is, you're going to be chastised. And that happened at the hotel. On the school visits, in terms of me experiencing whiteness, there was a level of formality. Not that people of color aren't formal, because they are, but the social norms that were present in some of the schools that we visited, a simple thing like what the reception area felt like. And it was a little cold, and I'll use the term austere. It was cold and austere, and the people that greeted us were very formal and rule-based. With the people of color that I met in some of those same spaces, it's a warm handshake and maybe a hug, maybe a kiss on the cheek, right? I'm new. You don't really know me. But communities of color tended to be a little more warm and less formal and less prescriptive. And I will say that even in those spaces where it started out austere and formal, I'm not giving a plug, but I am kind of sort of, because of the Protocol for Courageous Conversation. And one of those pieces is to meet people where they are. And locate them and meet them where they are, and then you can visit other places. That happened, right? And so because I know the tools and my colleagues know the tools, we were able to interact in that whiteness in such a way where it didn't fracture anybody in the space. We were able to honor what we encountered and show up. I could show up in my authentic self and experience a rich conversation and that I might not have experienced otherwise. If I didn't have any skills, it might have put me off and I might have shut down and not engaged with folks I encountered.
Yeah. Can we go a little bit deeper here? Because, you know, as the executive director of a global foundation, you're experiencing whiteness in all its forms across the globe. So what are the things that you do to build your resilience and capacity as an African American woman to kind of do that?
Well, the good news is I understand whiteness and I have navigated whiteness effectively most of my life, right? And so I am able to, again, like I was saying just a few minutes ago, meet people where they are and assess pretty quickly where there may be something in my personal story that connects to the place I'm in the moment, right? So if, even though I'm a Black woman, an African-American woman, I have to navigate whiteness in order to live, right? And there are places in my personal story where I can make a connection in whiteness. And once I've done that, then I can offer some things from my experience that might not fit as neatly into whiteness, right? But that's really the strategy, if you will, that I use across the globe when I'm interacting with folk. And I would say the other part is honoring the place that I'm in, because that's really important. The foundation doesn't come in with the notion that we know how to do things in this place. We know some tools that can be used, but whoever I'm talking, you know your place. I don't know it. And therefore, I have to be open to hearing somebody else's story so that we can make sense of the place we're in from their life text, because they know it much better than I ever will.
Yeah. That immediate context changing all the time and honoring the people and land on which you stand and finding your way into the existing conversation about race in that place is one of the most challenging aspects and one of the most important things, I believe, to get right in these conversations. Lasting impressions, and when are you coming back?
So lasting impression is there are so many people to meet and so much more to see here on this land. And I believe I've only scratched the surface of what's possible. And I'm so energized by the willingness of the people I've met to engage with Courageous Conversations and the Global Foundation. And I hope I'm coming back soon.
I hope you're coming back soon, too.
You're going to have me back?
Yeah, anytime you want.
Okay, I'm really excited. I want to spend more time in people's homes next time.
Cool, yeah.
I haven't had that to, you know.
Well, we've got a village. You can come and hang with us.
I'd love to.
Thank you so much for your time, Andrea. We wish you a safe journey home, and we'll see you again soon.
Thank you.
Kia ora.